I let the images slosh pleasantly around in my brain as I watched the wounds on his neck close and purple into faint bruises. "Did that hurt?" I asked, touching a fingertip to the fading mark. He cupped my face in his hands and wiped at the corners of my mouth with his thumbs. "That wasn't a pained moan." "Oh," I said, my voice thick and stupid. "Oh. You're a rather messy eater," he commented. "You should see me around barbecue," I said, yawning. "It gets ugly." "Well, I'm afraid I won't have that pleasure," he said, resting his chin on the top of my head. I raised my eyebrows, not quite catching the joke. "Is feeding always like that?" I asked. "So cozy?" "No." He stopped to pluck a pine needle out of my hair. "You set the tone. You needed to be soothed, so you were soothed. With a willing partner, feeding can be as violent, as sexual, as clinical and cold as the vampire wishes. And with a human, the sensations are much more intense. They're more susceptible to our charms." Vampire. There was that word again. And suddenly, I was awkward. I couldn't decide where to settle my weight. I wondered if I was crushing Gabriel's arm. I wondered if I had vampire morning breath. "Is Zeb going to be okay?" I asked, watching my friend snoring happily on my couch. Before, when you said that Zeb was my closest friend in the world, how did you know that?"
"Well, as I said earlier, before you ran out of my home like a crazy woman," he gave me an arch look, "I told you, you have a very organized mind. If I want a piece of information, I can just pluck it out."
I grimaced. "So you read my mind?" He grinned sheepishly.
"No. You tend to ramble a bit when you've had too much to drink. You told me about Zeb at the restaurant."
"That would be your version of humor, I assume?" I asked dryly. Gabriel actually looked contrite for a second. It passed in favor of a brighter, intrigued expression.
"You're not all that experienced in the sexual arena."
If this was a sitcom, I would have just spit water all over him.
"I told you that?"
I gaped at him. I couldn't think of a response rude enough, so I moved away under the pretense of checking on Zeb. Gabriel relaxed against the wall, watching me prowl the room.
"No, but I would be able to tell anyway. You smell different from most people. There's an innocence about you, a freshness. It's like the difference between cracking a good egg and a bad one."
"So I smell like a good, decent egg. Nice." I stopped in my tracks. "Wait, is this a nice-ish way of telling me we had sex and I was lousy? That's how you can tell I'm inexperienced? Because if so, that's just rude. And what were you doing at Shenanigans, and how did you find me on the road?" Gabriel looked wounded.
"To answer your questions in order, the only body fluid I exchanged with you is blood."
"That's very comforting, thank you."
"The bartender at Shenanigans is a vampire pet. He keeps pints of screened donated blood behind the bar. If you know to order the tequila sunrise special, he mixes palatable liquor with a healthy dose of blood."
"What's a vampire pet?" I asked, suddenly overwhelmed by a vision of humans on giant hamster wheels.
"A human who is marked and kept by a vampire as a companion and a willing source of blood," he said. "They often serve as daytime protectors and help the vampire stay in contact with the modern world. It's a beneficial relationship for both sides." "And after you left the restaurant, I was concerned for you," he said, reaching out to touch my hand. "I wanted to make sure you arrived home safely. Unfortunately, I didn't follow you close enough. I couldn't stop that hunter from taking his shot."
"But why did you turn me?" He ran a thumb along my brow.
"I just couldn't stand the idea of a life like yours being snuffed out in such a tragic, ridiculous way. You deserved a better death."
"Oh, well, thanks," I said. "How do you thank someone for turning you into a vampire? A fruit basket? Blood type of the month club?" He chuckled. I smiled. I was relaxing, feeling some reconnection to the charming, mysterious guy I'd met at the bar. In my head, I heard glasses clinking. I could smell imitation Calvin Klein cologne and the jalapeno poppers being served to the couple next to us. Through the fog of memory, I saw Gabriel's lips curve into a smile as I compared the relative merits of Elvis Presley and Johnny Cash. Johnny Cash had all the same talents and problems as Elvis. A poor upbringing in the rural South, exposure to gospel music throughout his childhood, a penchant for drug abuse, I heard myself saying against the background of chatter and clinking glasses. They had the same sort of influencing experiences, but Johnny Cash's problematic relationship was with his father, not his mother. If he'd had the mommy issues that Elvis had instead of a compelling need to prove himself to his father, he wouldn't have been the badass man in black, the guy in Folsom Prison watching the train roll by. Elvis was a lot of things, but even with the karate and the gunplay, he was more unstable than badass.
"But you're forgetting one thing," Gabriel had said, motioning for the bartender to bring me another cup of coffee. I'd sipped the coffee and added far too much cream and sugar.
"What's that?"
"Johnny Cash had June Carter."
I had smiled. "Good point."
"The love of a good woman can save a man," I remembered Gabriel saying, "or it can drive him into fits of unspeakable madness."
I had stared at him a long moment before bursting out laughing. "Well, now I know how to inscribe my next Valentine's Day card." Gabriel didn't seem accustomed to a woman laughing at him. It had taken him a few seconds, but then he was laughing too. Gabriel was a rare find. He was nothing like the men my age who lived in the Hollow. For one thing, he seemed to realize that wearing a baseball cap was not a substitute for combing one's hair. He seemed to enjoy the contents of my brain instead of looking at it as something that had to be canceled out by the contents of my bra. And I don't think he'd even heard of NASCAR. "How did we even get on this subject?" I'd asked, squinting at him.
"I honestly don't know," he had said, sipping his drink. "I asked you about your family's church background. You went on a tangent about having to sit through the annual all-gospel sing and Karen Newton's atonal warbling. Gospel led to Elvis, Elvis led to Johnny Cash. I don't think I've ever absorbed so much random trivia in one sitting. I do enjoy watching your mind work, though. I can practically see all the little cogs and wheels clicking into place. Tell me more. My knowledge of contemporary music is somewhat limited."
"Contemporary?" I'd laughed. "We're talking about rockabilly from the 1950s. Gabriel had raised his hands defensively.
"Well, I haven't bought an album in a while."
Looking back, I really should have picked up on that as a clue that I was dealing with a vampire. But I'd been too pleased with the ebb and flow of the conversation to pay attention. One subject leading to another, and another in lazy concentric circles like smoke rings over our heads. The memory was like reliving a pleasant dream, one that leaves you disappointed when you wake up and realize it wasn't real. Only, Gabriel was real, and it seemed I could pick this dream up again if I wanted. Now I touched Gabriel's shoulder and tried to speak as carefully as possible. "Look, I'm really grateful that you saved my life. I know what would have happened if you hadn't intervened. It's just, I've had so much to absorb, and I didn't adjust to change gracefully while I was living." He was quiet again, studying me intently, looking for rhyme or reason in a brain where I was sure he'd find little of either. I looked away, brushing at the bloodstains at the corners of my mouth with a tissue.
"So you're inexperienced," Gabriel said, more of a statement than a question.
"Yes, I thought we'd just covered this."
Gabriel would not be swayed from his line of questioning. "How?"
I blushed, a rush of Gabriel's blood coming to my cheeks. "That's none of your business."
"I only ask because vampires with even the slightest hint of innocence are rare these days. For that matter, humans with the slightest hint of innocence are rare these days. It's rather refreshing."
"Why don't you just put a big red stamp on my forehead?" I grumbled.
"Given your literary proclivities, why not a red letter sewn on your clothing?"
he asked, his lips quirked. I frowned at him. "I think it's time for you to go."
"I think I should stay and look after you," he said. "Your first few days can be a difficult transition. Your senses, your feedings..."
"It's already been a difficult transition." Besides, I wondered, where was Gabriel going to stay? Where would he sleep? Where would I sleep? Where would I get blood? Who would pry Zeb off my couch? "I just need some time to myself. I promise to send up the bat signal if I need you."
"After spending more time with your kind, you will realize that remark was in very poor taste," he said, rising. "I'll take your friend home."
I used some super speed of my own to block Gabriel's path to the couch. "Wait, you can't just take him. I mean, how do I know you're not going to snack on him on the way home?"
"I give you my word," he said, looking wounded again. He was awfully sensitive for someone who'd lived off the blood of the innocent for more than a century. But what specifically will you do? I demanded. You're not going to leave him in a ditch or anything, are you? You don't even know where he lives.
I've lived through 2 world wars in the disco era. I think I can manage.
I must have appeared unimpressed.
He sighed. I will look at his driver's license and take him home. I will use his keys to take him into his house. He will remember that you are a vampire, but he will have no memory of your attacking him.
You can just wipe his memory? I asked. Can I do that? Because I'd kind of like to get my Uncle Dave to stop telling the story about me flashing my panties at his wedding reception.
Gabriel stared at me.
I was 3, I explained. Pink panties were a big deal.
He snorted, an intriguing and undignified noise. Yes, you might develop the talent, and you may be able to replace those memories with new ones of your own design. It's a handy trick when one needs humans to forget how they sustained neck punctures. Every vampire has different abilities, talents, just as every human cannot carry a tune.
He trailed off as he read my horrified expression. He rolled his eyes, exasperated.
I'll give him a good memory, with sports victories and beer drinking.
Thank you, I said, wondering how my Zeb, my sweet Doctor Who-watching Zeb, would react to memories of touchdowns and Budweiser.
I will see you soon, Gabriel said, taking a step closer to me. I stepped back.
He let a frisson of disappointment pass over his features and hefted Zeb off the couch. Wait, I thought you had to be invited before you could go into someone's house, I said as Gabriel moved effortlessly to the door. He shifted, jiggling Zeb.
It's a common misconception, and under normal circumstances, we wouldn't. It's just rude.
I closed the front door behind Gabriel and locked it. Then I unlocked it. What the hell could an intruder do to me, really? Then again, I didn't want some Buffy wannabe sneaking into my house and staking me, so I turned the lock again. Irritated with myself, I sank to the floor and scrubbed my hand over my face. 3 days ago, I was a law-abiding librarian. I had a dental plan and baking soda in my fridge. Now I'm unemployed, undead, and apparently kind of skanky.
Rough day, pumpkin?
Yeah, I said, pressing the heels of my hands over my eyes to ward off a gathering headache. My great-aunt Jetty appeared at my left and pushed my hair back from my face.
Don't worry, honey. Things will work out. They always do.
Yeah, I said, willing myself not to cry. Vampires surely didn't blubber like little girls. Aunt Jetty patted my head fondly.
There's my girl.
I smiled up at her through watery eyes. Wait. My great-aunt was dead. The permanent kind of dead.
Aunt Jetty?
I yelped, sitting up and whacking my head against the wall behind me. Note to self, try to stop reacting to surprises like a cartoon character.
Hey, baby doll,
my recently deceased great-aunt murmured, patting me on the leg, or at least through my leg. My first skin-to-ectoplasm contact with the non-corporeal dead was an uncomfortable, cold-water sensation that jolted my nerves.
Blark.
I shuddered as subtly as possible so as not to offend my favorite deceased relative. Aunt Jetty looked great. Vaguely transparent, but great. Her luxuriant salt and pepper hair was twisted into its usual long braid over one shoulder. She was wearing her favorite UK t-shirt that read, I bleed blue. The sentiment was horribly appropriate, all things considered. It also happened to be the shirt she died in, struck by a massive coronary while fixing a flat on her 10-speed. She looked nothing like the last time I saw her, all primped up in one of my grandmother's cast-off suits and a rhinestone brooch the size of a Buick. Jetty Bell Early died at age 81, still mowing her own lawn, making her own apple wine, and able to rattle off the stats for every starting Wildcats basketball player since 1975. She took me under her wing around age 6, when her sister, my grandma Ruthie, took me to my first junior league tiny tea and then washed her hands of me. There was a regrettable incident with sugar cube tongs. Grandma Ruthie and I came to an understanding on the drive home from that tea, the understanding that we would never understand each other. Grandma Ruthie and her sister Jetty hadn't spoken a civil word in about 15 years. Their last exchange was Ruthie's leaning over Jetty's coffin and whispering, If you'd married and had children, there would be more people at your funeral.
Of course, at the reading of Aunt Jetty's will, Grandma Ruthie was handed an envelope containing a carefully folded, high-resolution picture of a baboon's butt. That pretty much summed up their relationship. Aunt Jetty, who never saw the point in getting married, was all too happy to have me for entire summers at River Oaks. We'd spend all day fishing in the stagnant little pasture pond if we felt like it, or I'd read as she puttered around her garden. It was better if I didn't help. I have what's known as a black thumb. We ate s'mores for dinner if we wanted them, or we'd spend evenings going through the attic, searching for treasures among the camphor-scented trunks of clothes and broken furniture. Don't get the wrong idea. My family isn't rich, just able to hold on to real estate for an incredibly long time. While Daddy took care of my classical education, Jetty introduced me to Matilda, Nancy Drew, and Little Men. Little Women irritated me. I just wanted to punch Amy in the face. Jetty took me to museums, UK basketball games, overnight camping trips. Jetty was included in every major event in my life. Jetty was the one who undid some of the damage from my mother's birds and bees talk entitled, "Nice Girls Don't Do That. Ever." She helped me move into my first apartment. Anyone can show up for stuff like graduations and birthdays. Only the people who truly love you will help you move. Despite her age and affection for fried food, I was knocked flat by Jetty's death. It was months before I could move her hairbrush and oil of Olay from the bathroom. Months before I could admit that as the owner of River Oaks, I should probably move out of my little bedroom with the peppermint stripe wallpaper and into the master suite. So seeing her crouch next to me with that "tell me your troubles" expression was enough to push me over the mental health borderline. "Oh, good. It's psychotic delusion time," I moaned. Jetty chuckled. "I'm not a delusion, Jane. I'm a ghost." I squinted as she became less translucent. "I would say that's impossible, but given my evening, why don't you explain it to me in very small words?" It was good to see that Jetty's deeply etched laugh lines could not be defeated by death. "I'm a ghost, a spirit, a phantom, a non-corporeal entity. I've been hanging around here since the funeral." "So you've seen everything?" She nodded. I stared at her, considering. "So you know about my disastrous 14-minute first date with Jason Brandt?" She looked irritated as she said, "Afraid so." "That's unfortunate." I blinked as my eyes flushed hot and moist. "I can't believe I'm actually sitting here talking to you. I've really missed you, Aunt Jetty. I didn't get to say goodbye before you... It was over so fast. I went to the hospital and you were gone. And then Grandma Ruthie started talking about moving all of your stuff out of the house. I felt so lost and everybody just seemed to be talking over me. Mama and Grandma Ruthie, they just acted as if my opinion didn't matter, even though I was the closest to you. And then the will was read and Grandma Ruthie just lost her mind in the middle of the lawyer's office and told me I had no right to the house and it wasn't supposed to go to me and she was going to contest the will as invalid because you were obviously mentally incompetent. And I didn't care about any of it because none of it was going to bring you back." "Honey," Aunt Jetty chuckled, "take a breath." "I don't need to anymore," I cried. In my years with Aunt Jetty, I'd learned to recognize her trying not to laugh face. She wasn't even making an attempt at it. She was just rolling around on the ground, braying like a hyena. "It's not funny," I cried, swatting through her insubstantial form. Jetty continued to cackle while I pouted. "It's a little bit funny," I admitted. "Dang it." "Change of subject. Did you get to see your whole life played over instrumental soft rock before you died? What about your funeral? I didn't get one because no one knows I'm dead, but did you get to see your funeral?"
"Yeah," Jetty grinned.
"Great turnout. Shame about the suit, though. Couldn't talk your grandma out of it, huh?"
I shrugged. "She wanted to send you to your grave with some semblance of decorum, or so she said."
"I looked like Barbara Bush in drag," Jetty snorted.
"Barbara Bush is dignified no matter what," I offered. "Hey, if you've been here all along, why can't I see you now?"
"Because I wanted you to see me."
Jetty seemed pained, brushing her icy fingers along my cheeks.
"And because you're different, your senses have changed. You're more open to what's beyond the senses of normal, living people. I don't know whether to be happy that you can see me or sad about what's happened to you, Sugar Pie. I groaned. See, now I know it's bad because the last time you called me Sugar Pie was right before telling me my turtle died. Awkward pause. So, what's it like being dead? I asked.
What's it like for you?
She countered. I sighed, even though I didn't have to, technically. Unsettling.
Good word, she nodded.
What do you do? I mean, is there some sort of unfinished business I need to help you complete in order to move on to the next plane? Her voice rose to a Vincent Price octave.
Yes, I'm wandering the earth seeking revenge on Ben and Jerry for giving me the fat ass and the massive coronary. And I give out love advice to the tragically lonely.
Is that an ironic eternal punishment for the lady who died an 81-year-old spinster? I grinned.
Single by choice, you twerp.
Banshee, I shot back.
Bloodsucker.
I leaned my head against her insubstantial shoulder. I missed you. A lot. Did I mention that?
A time or two, she said. I missed you like crazy, too. Even though I saw you every day, not being able to talk to you was just horrible. That's part of the reason I just couldn't let go. I wanted to keep an eye on you.
Well, good job, Aunt Jetty. I rolled my eyes. I lost my car keys 3 times last week, and I got turned into a vampire.
I know. As a guardian angel, I leave much to be desired, she said. But if it makes you feel any better, the car keys were my doing.
You hid my car keys?
Had to amuse myself somehow,
Jetty said, her eyes twinkling with ghostly mischief.
I may be dead, but I'm still me.
Remind me to have that stitched on a sampler, I muttered. Though this certainly explains the vaguely obscene limericks composed with my refrigerator poetry magnets. Jetty shrugged but seemed pleased to have been noticed. I looked out the window and saw the pink streaks of dawn curling into the clouds. I felt my strength leaching from my bones. I was so tired, even yawning seemed like a heroic effort. I couldn't think about how I was going to explain my 3-day disappearance to my parents, or that I may have started a badly fated relationship with a guy who regularly bites people. I couldn't think about the fact that I couldn't die or get a tan anymore. All I wanted was sleep. I climbed the stairs, drew the shades tight, and then threw a thick quilt over the curtain rod. I dropped into bed and felt Jetty's clammy hands brush my face as she pulled the quilts up to my chin. In a few minutes, I was, to use a bad pun, dead to the world. Chapter 4 Loved ones may be upset by your unexplained 3-day absence. If you're not comfortable talking about your newly risen condition, try plausible explanations like a severe stomach flu, emergency dental surgery, or temporary amnesia. From the Guide for the Newly Undead. When the phone started ringing around 7 a.m., I realized the wisdom of sleeping in a soundproof coffin.
It's jealousy, sweetheart. Nothing but pure jealousy,
Mama was saying when I pressed the receiver to my ear. Mama had dispensed with phone greetings years ago when I started giving her reasons I couldn't stay on the phone as soon as she said hello.
Mavis Stubblefield has had it in for me ever since I beat her in the Miss Half Moon Hollow pageant in 1967. She's been waiting for years to get back at me, and now she's gone and fired you. Jealousy.
Yeah, Mama, I'm sure that's what it's all about, I said, straining to see the clock. Wait, why wasn't Mama screaming at me for disappearing? Why wasn't she reliving the 26 hours of labor she suffered only to birth a child who didn't call her every day? Why wasn't she reminding me that it was 7 a.m. and I was still unmarried? In my head, I cobbled together an explanation, which was impressive, considering the whopping 2 hours of sleep. Mama, did you get a phone call this morning? I asked, burrowing under the quilts. A really early phone call?
Oh, yes, honey, from your Gabriel,
she chirped as if she and the sexiest man not quite alive were exchanging recipes before dawn. And when did he become my Gabriel?
He explained, well, I can't remember what he said exactly, but I understood that you needed some time to yourself after you were so unfairly let go. I'm just happy that you found someone so charming to spend your time with.
Okay, I murmured, deeply sorry that I'd cast aspersions on the ethics of mind-wiping. I owed Gabriel a fruit basket and a membership in the Blood Type of the Month Club.
"Since you're free today, why don't you meet Jenny and me for lunch?"
Mama asked. "I don't think I'll be getting out much today, Mama." Mama gasped.
"Why, honey, are you sick? Broke? Hurt?"
"Mama," I shouted over the din of loving maternal intrusion. "Just come over after dinner and we'll talk." Mama's smothering instinct could not be denied.
"Do you want me to bring you anything? I could make a pot pie."
"No food. After dinner. Bring Daddy." I hung up before she could answer. How was I going to explain this to my parents? I foresaw a good deal of blaming and wailing in my immediate future. I pulled the pillow over my face in a lame attempt to suffocate myself, and then I remembered I didn't need to breathe. Dang it.
"Don't worry, Pumpkin. I locked the doors. No one, meaning your mama, is going to barge in,"
Jetty said, materializing at the foot of my bed. I shrieked, launching the pillow through her.
"Can you knock or put a bell around your neck or something?" I grumped. "Maybe rattle some chains before you walk into a room?" "It's good to see you're still a morning person,"
Jetty teased, tossing the pillow back at me.
"Don't worry, honey. If your mama comes over, I'll just give her the usual. Cold chills, goose bumps, a vague feeling of unease as if she's left the iron on. Nobody sticks around with that stuff going on."
"Thanks, Aunt Jetty," I said, falling asleep before the blanket settled over me. As the sun set, my eyes snapped open. I felt great, energized, refreshed. All of the things those fancy mattresses are supposed to do for you. I bounded out of bed and threw the curtains back to bring in the moonlight. I wondered where I could get some of those fancy blackout shades that hotels use. I made a mental note to look up vampire redecorating websites. I heard a knock at my front door, and my good mood dissipated. Mama was early. Knowing there was no time to get dressed, I trotted down the stairs and prepared for the parental pajama critique.
"Yoo-hoo!"
I skidded to a stop. Mama never said, "Yoo-hoo." I opened the front door. There was a pair of shapely legs sticking out from under a ridiculously large pink-wrapped gift basket. My world just kept getting weirder and weirder. "Hello?"
"Hi," the legs said. "I'm Missy Houston of the Newly Undead Welcoming Committee, Kentucky Division."
My uneasiness at letting a strange vampire into my home battled the manners Mama had pounded into my marrow. Manners, marrow, and Mama won out. "Would you like to put that down?"
"Thanks. Inhuman strength or not, this thing's heavy," she huffed,
putting the mega basket on my foyer table. Missy was wearing a perky petal pink Chanel knockoff suit with a matching faux coach purse and heels. Even the headband in her perfectly flipped champagne-colored hair was pink. It was comforting to know that I didn't have to give up pastels in my afterlife. I looked washed out and black.
"It's so nice to meet a newcomer," Missy trilled in her melted sugar twang,
more Texas than Kentucky. We tend to abuse our long I sounds as opposed to all the sounds. Missy shook my hand in a digit-crushing grip. Unsure of whether this was some sort of test, I resisted wincing and squeezed right back. "Jane Jameson," I said, keeping a bland smile plastered across my face.
"How did you know I've been turned, vamped out, recruited to the Legion of Soulless Bloodsuckers?"
She trilled again at my perplexed expression.
"Oh, Shug, you've got to keep your sense of humor about being undead. Otherwise, you'll just go toppling over the abyss into madness."
Yet another throw pillow saying to be stitched.
"I can sense the location of other vampires, their energy,"
Missy explained.
"Newbies tend to give off mega waves when they rise. That's why I'm in charge of the welcome wagon."
"Makes sense," I nodded. "Haven't I seen you before?"
"On my billboards, most likely. Up until 2 years ago, I was one of the top-selling real estate agents in the Tri-County area. I went to a convention in Boca Raton. I had one too many margaritas, met a tall, pale, and handsome man in the bar, and woke up a vampire."
"I was mistaken for a deer and got shot,"
I offered.
Oh.
Finally, she was speechless. It didn't last long.
I have always loved this house. Great upkeep considering the age. They just don't make them like this anymore. High ceilings, huge kitchen, wonderful windows, great natural light, even though you can't really appreciate that now. Original hardwood floors?
I nodded, watching Aunt Jetty materialize at her writing desk. I glanced over to Missy, who was still appraising my floors as her needle-thin heels clicked on the polished wood. She didn't notice the dearly departed Wildcats fan scowling in the corner.
"Well, this is just a little welcome gift from the local branch of the council," Missy was saying. "Sort of an orientation in a basket. SPF 500 sunblock, iron supplements, floss, a six-pack of faux type O, a bottle of plasma protein powder, and the numbers of every vamp-friendly blood bank in the tri-state area. There's also a copy of the guide for the newly undead."
"There's a handbook?" I asked, plucking it from the pink-wrapped cornucopia. "Thank God." Aunt Jetty cleared her throat and rolled her eyes toward Missy. "Well, this is very sweet," I said. "I really appreciate it. I'm sure I'll see you at the next potluck or something." Missy laughed, swinging her tiny pink bag onto her arm.
"You're gonna be a hoot at the meetings, I can tell."
"Meetings? I was just kidding." A few more minutes of polite chit-chat and Missy was firmly ensconced in her black Cadillac. After watching her taillights depart through the window, I turned to Aunt Jetty. What was with the facial charades?
"I just can't stand little mismatching everything,"
Jetty sneered as I toted the basket into my cheerful yellow kitchen with blue gingham curtains and set it on the white tile counter next to the cookie jar shaped like a cheeky raccoon. Jetty perched next to the sink.
"Back when she was living, she tried to talk me into listing this place with her. Said that maybe I needed to go into one of those nice assisted living places, the little snot."
"Why couldn't she see you? I thought seeing ghosts is one of the benefits of being undead."
"I didn't want her to see me," Jetty said.
"Well, she brought treats, so she's not half bad in my book," I told her, removing the ginormous pink bow. As my stomach rumbled, I read over the label of faux type O. From what I'd heard, it was the rolling rock of artificial bloods, light and palatable with a smooth finish and 120% of your recommended daily allowance of hemoglobin.
"A stranger drops fake blood on your doorstep and you're going to drink it?" Jetty asked. "I thought we had a nice long talk about stranger danger when you were 7.
"There's a safety seal." I held it up for her inspection. "It's either this or I go hunting for hitchhikers to feed on." Jetty covered her eyes, but she was able to see through her hands. I was not exactly thrilled at the prospect of snacking on the blood equivalent of Cheese Whiz, but I needed to get used to it. There was no way I was feeding on live victims on a regular basis. I couldn't stand the thought of hunting when I was living. Obviously, that was some sort of cruelly ambiguous psychic foreshadowing. What the hell? If it was gross, I had a package of fudge Pop-Tarts that I could rub on the raw hamburger in my fridge. Faux type O came in little plastic jugs that reminded me of milk bottles. I popped the top and sniffed. It wasn't bad, vaguely yeasty and salty. Jetty came in for a closer look. "Do you mind?" I asked as she picked up a pencil and poked at my right upper fang. I brought the bottle to my lips, pinched my nose, and swallowed. It rolled past my lips, thick and smooth. I didn't gag, which I took as a good sign.
"How is it?" Jetty asked.
"Not bad," I said, rolling the remnants off my tongue. "It has a kind of Diet Coke aftertaste, artificial and beefy."
"You make it sound just delightful," Jetty snorted as I drained the bottle.
I wiped my mouth and tossed the bottle into the recycling bin. "So, you're dead," I said. "I wasn't together enough last night to ask, what exactly do you do all day, besides hide my keys?"
"I listen to your phone calls, make you feel like you're being watched, move things around, create cold spots."
At this point, I glared at her. Unmoved, she levitated my dish of Hershey Kisses just to show she could.
"Sometimes I visit other spirits around town. You wouldn't believe how haunted the Hollow is.
Oh, I think my mind is being opened up to the possibility, I said dryly. Give me a for instance.
Well, the golf course. If people realize how many dead men in ugly pants are wandering around there, they wouldn't go near it,
she said, smirking like the proverbial cat with a canary and or cream.
Including your Grandpa Fred.
Oh, I loved Grandpa Fred, I said, pouting, which was difficult considering the fangs. I hate to think of him wandering the earth for eternity in plaid polyester.
Oh, he's fine, honey, she waved a hand. Happy as a clam, and even happier now that we've been seeing each other.
You mean you're seeing him as in dating him? I honestly don't know what to say to that. I shook my head.
I can't help it if your grandma married all of the good-looking men in town. We were bound to cross paths sometime,
Jetty said, shrugging. She had a point. To recall childhood memories of my grandmother, I didn't need the scent of oatmeal cookies or ivory soap, just designer imposter Chanel No. 5 and hearing the phrase,
"Darling, I've met the most wonderful man."
My grandma Ruthie, Jetty's sister, had been married 4 times. So many times that I started calling every old man I saw at the grocery store Grandpa. Mama put a stop to that after Grandpa number 4, Fred. He was a nice man. Shame about the lightning strike. All of Grandma Ruthie's husbands had died under weird circumstances. A milk truck hit Grandpa John, my real grandpa, back in the days when milk was actually delivered door to door. Grandpa Tom had a heretofore unknown allergy to rhubarb and had an anaphylactic reaction while Grandma was baking her famous strawberry rhubarb pie. Grandpa Jimmy died from a brown recluse bite on the inside of the throat. His doctor's article on the improbability of such a bite was published in several medical journals. And poor Fred, struck down on the 12th hole at the Half Moon Hollow Public Golf Course. It's a wonder Grandma hadn't been questioned by the police, or at least gotten a cool nickname like the Black Widow. Of course, that would probably be in poor taste given what happened to Grandpa Jimmy. That was why I was allowed to go to the Wacky Rivers Water Park with Ray Summerall on the day of Jimmy's funeral. Apparently, Mama realized that it wasn't normal for a little girl to have a designated funeral dress. After Fred, she told Grandma it was time to slow her prolonged death march down the aisle. Grandma had been dating a very nice man named Bob for the last 5 years. They'd been engaged for 4.5. Bob was proof that medical science could keep pretty much anyone alive. He'd had his gallbladder, one of his lungs, part of his pancreas, and his prostate removed. He spent more time in the hospital than out. Why was this sweet man engaged to my grandma? I can only imagine that he actually wanted to die, and he saw marriage to her as his only way out.
As long as Ruthie keeps killing off husbands, I'll have an active social afterlife,
Jetty preened. That's just gross, I shuddered. But maybe your committing postmortem infidelity will distract Mama and Daddy from my nifty new nocturnal lifestyle. Jetty blanched.
Your parents are coming here? Now? Oh, honey, that's not going to go well.
Thanks, that helps, I told her, stuffing the pink bow and cellophane into the trash. I bet you $10 Mama shows up with a pot pie. Mama's almost-from-scratch chicken pot pie was my favorite BD meal, all crusty and filled with cream of chickeny goodness. I already missed it, though I did have 7 of them in my freezer. Mama operated under the assumption that I was 8 years old and incapable of feeding myself. It was physically impossible for her to cross my threshold without some form of nourishment. She once offered me cheese crackers from her purse while we were standing in my kitchen. Like Grandma Ruthie, Mama attributed Jetty's leaving me River Oaks to senility. Obviously, it would have been much better to leave the family manse to my sister, Jenny, who would be able to care for the house properly. Crafty, thrifty, and the proud owner of an industrial-grade glue gun, Jenny made Martha Stewart look like a bag lady. And she fulfilled each of my mother's daughterly requirements by being A, elected cheerleading captain in high school, B, married to a chiropractor right after graduating from paralegal school, C, the mother of two boys, Andrew and Bradley. They were barely children, really, more like hyper badgers in Abercrombie and Fitch t-shirts. Nonetheless, Jenny assumed that bearing fruit of her loins meant that all family possessions funneled to her. After I moved into River Oaks, I found dozens of little pre-printed Jenny stickers marking a good deal of the antiques. In anticipation of Aunt Jetty dropping dead, Jenny had surreptitiously tattooed furniture, figurines, and family portraits with the little blue dots to claim dibs on what she saw as her share of the inheritance. Fortunately, Aunt Jetty's ironclad, very specific will prevented what I'm sure would have been a posthumous robbery. But I was still finding stickers in strange places. I had no idea how she managed to stick them without me seeing her. She was like a greedy ninja. From the front walk, I could hear Mama haranguing my father about this big old place and how a single girl like me couldn't keep up with mowing the lawn or cleaning the gutters. The house didn't actually have gutters, but to point that out would tip them off to my super hearing.
"Jenny could have turned this into a real showplace," Mama was saying as I climbed the front steps. "And Jane, well, she never had any sense for decorating, and I just worry about her being out here all alone."
"She can take care of herself, Sherry," Daddy said, his tone weary. He seemed more and more weary these days when dealing with Mama. My father. What can I say about the man who read with me every night from birth? And I'm not talking Goodnight Moon or Pat the Bunny. I'll bet I'm the only person on Earth to hear two Lincoln biographies before my first birthday. Daddy was the head of the history department at the local community college. It colored his parenting techniques. Daddy was the one who persuaded Mama not to enter me in the Little Miss Half Moon Hollow pageant. He was the one who declared that it was wrong to put me at another family's table at my sister's wedding. If not for his regrettable taste in middle names, he would be father of the century. "Hi, baby," he said as I opened the door. He kissed my cheek, smelling of old books and aqua velva. Before I could answer, Mama was shoving a hot, foil-wrapped bundle into my hands and checking my furniture for dust.
"Don't you worry, honey. Everything will be fine," she said, bustling through my kitchen to check for dirty dishes.
Setting the pot pie aside, I led Mama into the living room before she could start alphabetizing my spice rack. And then we started our usual passive-aggressive conversational volley.
"Don't you worry about not being able to find another job," Mama said, wiping her fingers down my mantle.
My internal response? "That hadn't occurred to me, Mama, but thank you."
"Nobody I've talked to thinks being fired was your fault."
"Exactly how many people have you talked to?"
"I've already talked to Dee Dee about you working down at the quilt shop with me."
Oh, good merciful St. Jude on toast. After Jenny and I hurtled from the nest, Mama took a part-time job at A Stitch in Time, a shop that sold fabric and quilting supplies. In the 5 years she had worked there, I'd received quilted vests for every birthday and Christmas. I hope this gives you some idea of what I was dealing with. I couldn't visit my mother at the shop for more than a few minutes at a time. I had allergic reactions to fabric sizing and old women asking me when I was going to settle down. Working there would be my damnation to whatever circle of hell is dedicated to busybodies and fabric artists. "Oh, Mama, I don't think that would be possible. Ever." Aunt Jetty appeared at my right, laughing her phantom butt off. I growled at a decibel level below human hearing.
"Let me help," Jetty whispered.
I shook my head imperceptibly. She rolled her eyes and faded out of sight.
"Mama, I think you and Daddy need to sit," Mama sighed. "Now, Jane, I don't want you moping around this big old place by yourself. I think for the time being, you should move back in with Daddy and me."
St. Jude had just jumped from the toaster to the frying pan. I made a sound somewhere between a screech and a wheeze. Sensing my distress, Daddy said, "Oh, Sherry, leave the girl alone. Can't you see she's got something to tell us?" "Thanks, Daddy," I said, motioning for them to sit on the couch. Mama fluffed the pillows and beat unseen dust from the cushions before making herself comfortable. Jetty popped up behind the sofa. It was so weird that they had no idea she was standing less than a foot behind them.
"Tell them you're pregnant with a married minister's baby, then say, 'Just kidding, I'm a vampire,'" she suggested.
"Not helping," I whispered.
"What's that, honey?"
Mama asked,
buffing fingerprints off my coffee table.
"Well, I have some interesting, exciting news," I said, stalling.
"It's about that Gabriel, isn't it?"
Mama squealed.
"You're engaged?"
"Mama, I've only known him for 3 days," I cried. Mama made that sigh combination sound only mothers can master.
"Well, are you at least seeing him? Have you tried dressing a little more feminine, making an effort? You know you're not getting any younger."
I snorted. I wouldn't be getting any older, for that matter. "Mama, I don't think you're
never going to get married if you don't lower your standards a little bit. Mama, don't you want to be settled, get married, have a family?"
"Mama," I shouted, "I'm not engaged. I'm not dating anyone. Time slowed. I could read every muscle, every pore in my parents' faces. Daddy's eyes were narrowed, considering me carefully. Worry crinkled the lines at the edges of his eyes. Mama's mouth was drawn, clearly expecting some sort of bad news beyond "your daughter was fired in a spectacularly public manner that will be chewed over for months." Their emotions came in stinging slaps of scent. Confusion, disappointment, irritation, sadness, impatience, a sour haze that was making my head ache. And that was just from Mama. My eyes burned with unshed tears. How do you tell someone that their child has died? How do you explain when that child is sitting in front of them, seemingly alive? How do you tell your parents that you've moved beyond them on the evolutionary scale, and that your mama's going to need to serve O negative alongside her Thanksgiving gravy? Well, I didn't, because I'm a great big coward. "I'm not ready to date anybody right now, Mama," I said, swiping at my eyes. "And I'm not going to move back home. I just need some time to focus on finding a new job and figuring out what I'm going to do next. I'll be fine."
"I told you you're going to come work at the quilt shop with me," she insisted.
"No, just no." Her lip trembled as she heaved a sigh and stared at the ceiling. Oh, crap. She did the same thing when I announced I was attending college 300 miles away and finally severing that pesky umbilical cord. That was the Christmas I got my first quilted vest. You have to admire a woman who exacts revenge through handicrafts.
"What's wrong with working at the quilt shop?"
"Nothing," I cried.
"Do you have something better planned?"
she demanded. "No," I said, "but I have planned not to work at the quilt shop." I looked to Daddy for help, but he was staring out the window with a puzzled expression.
"What's this interesting news, then?" Mama demanded. "You said you had interesting news."
I groped for some plausible fib. Fortunately, this was the moment Daddy noticed the absence of Big Bertha.
"Janie, where's your car?"
"Oh, it broke down the other night," I said a little too quickly. "It's in a shop over in Murphy. That's kind of what held me up for the last couple of days." Daddy scrutinized my face. I made a comprehensive study of the crown molding. I've never been able to lie to my father. I rat myself out before I can be accused of anything. The one time I smoked pot in college, I called Daddy the next morning to confess because the idea that he could find out any other way made me want to throw up. After expressing extreme disappointment and making me feel 2 feet tall, he promised not to tell Mama because she would have made me leave school to enter rehab that very minute. It's not exactly a healthy dynamic, but it's the only one we have. I managed to shush the two of them long enough to describe Big Bertha's post-shenanigans breakdown. Mama proceeded to skin Daddy for not performing routine maintenance on that old hunk of junk. Over the din, I gave a heavily edited version of my long walk home that night. I decided to omit the part about being shot or identifying the drunken hunter. I did not like Bud McElroy. At the same time, I didn't want my cousins Dwight and Oscar to beat Bud bloody with a sock full of batteries. Is that considered forgiveness? I also skirted around the "got turned into a vampire" portion of the proceedings. Again, I'm a huge coward. I told them I'd been so caught up in the wounds to my pride I just couldn't face anybody. I'd hold up at an undisclosed location to think. Technically, that wasn't a lie. It was stretching the truth to the breaking point, but it wasn't a lie.
"But we're your family,"
Mama huffed, stretching the word out to
family in a way that set my fangs on edge. Being family justified a lot of things in Mama's book, including signing me up for an online matchmaking service without my consent and attempting to wax my eyebrows while I was napping.
Who are you going to turn to if not your family? That's why you need to come stay with us, Janie. You need someone to take care of you.
I'm 27 years old, I cried. I can take care of myself. I don't need you folding my laundry and pouring my Cheerios every morning.
Jetty appeared at my left and whispered,
I can take their car keys if you want me to, Pumpkin.
You think I want to prevent them from leaving? I whispered back.
Who are you talking to?
Mama demanded, turning to my father.
John, she's talking to herself.
I'm not...
I started, then reconsidered the wisdom of reintroducing my parents to dear departed Aunt Jetty, who never liked my mother anyway.
Yes, I am. I'm talking to myself.
And you won't even think about coming back home?
Mama asked.
Mama, you remember what it was like when I lived at home. I think one of us would go insane, I said, and I don't think it would be you.
Well, if you're going to be that way, I'm not going to stay here and be insulted.
She exhaled her, you don't care how much I worry about you, martyr's sigh. She tucked her handbag under her arm in a prim gesture and made her way to the door.
John?
Daddy shot me a bewildered look and rose.
We'll talk soon, honey.
Bye, Daddy. I kissed his cheek. Love you. He squeezed my hand and winked at me.
Love you too, Pumpkin.
John!
Mama yelled from my front porch. As Daddy walked out, Mama poked her head back inside.
Just pop that pot pie in the oven to reheat at 350 for 30 minutes.
Then she disappeared, leaving me and Aunt Jetty gaping after her. I flopped down on the couch. I'm adopted, right? Or maybe Dad had some torrid affair with a brilliant but sensible humanities professor? I was the result of their passion, and Dad forced Mama to raise his bastard child as her own?
Nope,
Jetty said, shaking her translucent head.
She's your mother, I asked. Plus, you do look a bit like her. When you're angry, you both get these tense lines around your mouth. Look, there they are.
You're lucky you're dead already, I said, chucking a throw pillow at her.
It went right through her torso and bounced off the TV cabinet.
So, you didn't tell them,
Jetty observed as I stomped into the kitchen, my bare feet slapping loudly on the tile.
Nothing gets by you,
I muttered, whipping the aluminum foil cover off Mama's pot pie.
I just couldn't. Did you see the looks on their faces? They're already freaked out by the whole unemployed spinster daughter who lives alone thing. I don't think I want to add dead and drinks blood to the mix right now.
You have to tell them, Janie,
Jetty said, in a firmer tone than she normally takes with me.
Did you hear Jane's a vampire? Is not something you want your parents to overhear at the coffee spot.
I will tell them at some point. I just need to get a better fix on my powers, my schedule.
Fraidy cat,
Jetty muttered.
Poltergeist, I shot back.
The pie was still warm, the gloriously flaky golden crust buckling under my fingers as I scooped out a bite. But it smelled off, as if the cream of chicken had expired, and the onions were strong enough to make my eyes water.
Honey, you don't want to do that,
Jetty said.
Look, there are strings attached to this pot pie.
I haven't eaten solid food in 3 days, I told her.
I don't know if I can watch this,
Jetty said, blanching.
Pot pie is not finger food.
Shh! I shoveled the rich, warm pie into my mouth, expecting the pleasant childhood memories I normally associated with the meal to come flooding back to me.
Pot pie was one of the few meals Jenny and I could agree on, so Mama made it often. The meals tended to be tension-free because my mouth was full and I couldn't argue with anybody. Instead of the homey flavors of my childhood, I tasted dirt. Ash. Dirt. Gym clothes. I spat the casserole out and yelled something along the lines of blah, 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 and ran for the wastebasket. After I'd tossed up whatever was left in my stomach, I wiped my tongue with a blue gingham dish towel.
It tastes, ugh, it tastes like disappointment and feet. It tastes like you cooked it, I shuddered.
Jetty frowned.
I don't see why that comment was necessary.
The truth hurts.
So, no solid food, then? She asked brightly. I guess I'll just empty that box of Hostess cupcakes into the trash. You can't eat them after all.
Now see, that's just mean. Chapter 5. While it's tempting to try to resume your normal social activities with still living friends, you must understand that some people will have difficulty adjusting to your new condition. Warning signs that loved ones may be planning to stake you include a sudden interest in carpentry and staring at your chest to gauge where your heart is located. From the Guide for the Newly Undead. My visit with Zeb didn't start out much better than the pot pie episode. Unable to determine where my car might be, I walked to the 1970s-era brick ranch house Zeb rented on Jefferson Street. Zeb had moved out of his parents' home as soon as it was legal. He even lived on Jetty's couch for 2 months while he saved enough to land this little piece of shag-carpeted heaven. Zeb's family? Well, let's just say that they make the Osbournes look like a bunch of teetotaling Nobel laureates. Is it any wonder that the one-bedroom and semi-private bath life appealed to my Zeb? The house was far from what you would consider homey. He had lived there for 5 years and was still using orange plastic milk crates as a coffee table. The only sign that someone actually lived in the house was the yard gnome smirking next to an overgrown hosta. We stole the gnome from my neighbor, Mrs. Turnbow, our junior year of high school, and dubbed him Goobert McWindershins. There were wine coolers involved. Mama found out about it and made us take Goobert back to Mrs. Turnbow. We reclaimed him the week after Zeb moved to Jefferson Street and left $25 in her mailbox. I knocked on the door. No response. I walked around the corner of the house and opened the gate. A vaguely canine shape streaked up and stopped just short of me. My pitifully ugly dog, Fitz, whimpered, circled, and sat staring at me. A low growl sounded from his throat, and my heart broke. My own dog didn't recognize me. I could handle unemployment, a strict new diet, and Mama's hissy fits, but this had me teetering on the edge of an undead nervous breakdown. "Fitz, it's me," I said, holding my hand out for him to sniff. He stared at me. This dog freaks out and runs to the door every time a Domino's commercial comes on TV, so his mental processes are not the swiftest. I agonized as he considered, then finally bounded up to lick my face. I screeched with joy and let him knock me to the ground. "Oh, how's my buddy? How's my Fitz? Did you miss me?" Cooing like an idiot, I rolled him over and scratched his belly. Fitz was the apparent result of a one-night stand between a Great Dane and a loofah. His coat was the color of that stuff that grows in your shower. He was so big that his paws rested on my shoulders when he stood on his hind legs. Loose folds of skin hung over his eyes, so he viewed most of the world with his head tipped back. Fitz's one claim to distinction is that I named him after Mr. Fitzwilliam Darcy from Pride and Prejudice. I have Jane Austen issues. "I'm so, so sorry I went away without telling you, but I'll make it up to you, I promise," I said, scrubbing behind his ears. His eyes lolled back as he leaned into the scratch, which meant I was forgiven. It was then that Zeb, my best friend, the Frick to my Frack, the Shaggy to my Velma, fumbled through his screen door, swaying under the weight of dozens of crucifixes. "Back!" he shouted. "Back!" Fitz and I both cocked our heads as I marveled at the sheer number of chains around Zeb's skinny neck. Gold plate, silver, rhinestone, day-glow orange plastic. Zeb advanced on me, holding an old rosewood cross his Grandma McBride used to keep nailed to her wall. "Back, demon! Out of my sight!" "Oh, for goodness sake!" I rolled my eyes. Nonplussed, Zeb shook the cross like a shoddy flashlight and waved it at me again. "The power of Christ compels you!" Interesting tactics from the guy who hasn't set foot in a church in 15 years. Ah! It was embarrassing to be stabbed, especially when one considered my new cat-like reflexes. I can only say that I didn't expect it. Zeb passed out when we dissected frogs in junior high. He won one fight in high school, and that was because Steve McGee tripped and fell onto Zeb's fist. But still, there I was, mocking Zeb's over-accessorizing one minute, and the next, the orange plastic hilt of his carving knife was protruding from my gut. "Ow! It has to be wood, you doorknob, and it has to be in the heart," I yelled. My experience with stab wounds was limited, but it was certainly different from being shot. This was a cold sensation, the flimsy steel embedded in my flesh like a splinter. The wound itched as I wiggled the blade out of my stomach back and forth, a loose wound that annoyed more than it pained. I hissed as I pulled it free, glaring at a thunderstruck Zeb. We watched as my skin knit itself back together, the tendrils of muscle and skin tissue reaching out to restore itself. I smacked Zeb's shoulder. "Dumbass!" I cried, tossing the knife away.
I'm sorry," he sputtered.
The shock of what he'd done had apparently broken the violent vigilante spell.
"I just panicked."
Fitz loped after the knife to retrieve it. Fascinated, we stared as my idiot dog managed to drag the knife back by its plastic handle and drop it at our feet. Zeb grabbed it and rammed it into my thigh.
"Ow!"
I yelped, shoving him hard enough for the weight of the crosses to tip him onto his back.
"If you stab me one more time, I'm going to kill you."
"Not funny, ha-ha, kill you. Literally suck the life out of you. And giving me the chair will obviously do the state no good." I pulled the knife out again. Zeb sat up enough to watch the wound close again. My jaw dropped. "Zeb Lavelle, are you stabbing me just to watch me heal up?" He looked defensive.
"No."
"I'm so going to bite you." I tossed the knife up onto Zeb's roof and glared at the crossapalooza. "Would you take those stupid things off?"
"So, you're afraid of the crosses?"
he said, holding a neon orange plastic monstrosity up in a protective gesture.
"No, I'm afraid of people who look like Mr. T."
I shook my head. "Is there a gumball machine in town left intact?"
"Well, I remembered enough of last night to know